Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. My name is Rob Farley, and with me today are front pagers Scott Lemieux and Dave Watkins. Say hi, guys.
How you doing?
Hello.
So we today are attempting to finish a project that we started a couple weeks ago in which we revisited the top films of 1999, which is now widely regarded by critics as one of the strongest years in the modern history of cinema. If you'd like to revisit, you can take a look at the previous podcast in which we deal with 10 films from that year. We are going to try to be a little bit more ambitious this time and perhaps get through 20, but we will see where we end up. And so, with that, we are ready to go. So, gentlemen, dive into this here. Number 14. So last time we got through Fight Club, which was number 15. We're going to start off with number 14, which is The Straight Story, which is, in a sense, the weirdest David Lynch movie we have access to. My own special memory of this is sort of verbally abusing Scott into trying to go and watch this movie one evening while he had some midterm to finish for his advisor or something. That's really the most I remember, and I haven't revisited it since then.
Yeah, I don't think I've revisited it since that year either, which is a little bit unusual for me.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of it's a very good Lynch movie, but not really one that rewards rewatching. Like, I don't even know. Like, I think Mulholland Drive's a little better, but it's like much higher on the sort of rewatchability scale. In ways that, you know, The Straight Story is like, it's really well done, but it's probably not going to reveal lots of, like, you know, other nuances being viewed again. And maybe it would, I don't know. But for whatever reason, it hasn't really brought me back.
It would be kind of, I think, it would be fairly poignant to watch it again now with the knowledge that Richard Farnsworth knows he's dying as he's shooting the film, which, you know.
That's very true, yeah.
Right. Now, he committed suicide. He's committed suicide shortly after this, and he was ill at the time. Is that my understanding?
That's correct. Although he did go to the he had terminal cancer. He had, you know, months to live. But he did go to the Academy Awards, I think. He was
really?
The oldest nominee.
Oh, cool.
I could be wrong about that. I thought he was the oldest nominee for Best Actor.
No, that sounds plausible to me. It doesn't sound all that unreasonable. Whenever I see anyone driving along the road on a lawnmower, I think of this film. And to be honest, that's not all that often. So, all right. So, moving down the list to number 13. Now, I believe Scott, you may have said that you've never seen this. I'm not sure. So this is really the world's introduction to M. Night Shyamalan. And this is still a movie that I will defend. I will defend 2.5 of his films, the other one being Unbreakable and whatever the first one was with the sequel to Unbreakable was. But I will not defend Glass because it was not good. I think that, you know, Haley Joel Osment's performance in this film is still as good as advertised from a kid of his age. It's still one of the best child performances that I've ever seen. I don't know. It still appeals to me.
I think this is another good example of a film where, and I harbor anti spoiler sentiments. Right, I usually don't care. I'm really glad I didn't know. You know, we talked about this with Fight Club a little bit. I'm really glad I didn't know the twist going into the movie.
I had no idea. I had no idea what the twist was going to be.
Yeah, and I think one reason that I haven't seen it is that, and it wasn't like I was hostile, but it was one of those things for whatever reason. When you guys saw it, our schedules didn't link up. You know, none of my other friends were that into it. And then by the time I would have got around to it, I knew the twist. I still remember, like, everybody else discussing, like, I think it was like at one of Claire's political theory readings or something, and everybody's sort of discussing the twist. And it's one of those movies that might, like, because there are a lot of movies that, like, you know, like, I knew, like, Ralph Cifaretto was getting killed before I saw that episode of The Sopranos, but it doesn't really, you know, but it does strike me, and you guys can tell me, but it's the kind of movie that becomes a lot less essential if you know the twist all along, that it really is valuable to have seen it cold. So that's the reason why, like, I have no reason to think that it isn't good, but just for whatever reason, I've never gotten. And then obviously the decline in Shyamalan's career is not, you know, tempting me to go back. Although, again, I don't think think that that means that the first two Murphys weren't good, just that, you know, for whatever reason, that has never been a top priority of mine to go back and see it.
Well, I mean, I think that the term high on his own supply was almost almost invented for M. Night Shyamalan. And this is really, you can see which direction he's going to go wrong with this movie. I mean, basically, it's entirely predictable. And so, it's not surprising.
And I'm guessing the phrase high on, the phrase on high on our own supply will also come up when we get to The Matrix, I assume, but that's what
Yeah, I mean, that'll be interesting, right? I mean, I think that there are more complications with that, but yes.
Right.
All right, so number 12. Now, I am going to shamefully admit that I have yet to see Princess Mononoke, although I have seen many of his other films and many of the other Studio Ghibli films. But I have not seen this still, even though I have kids and I know they'd love it.
Yeah, this is one of the only Miyazaki films that I haven't seen, I think.
That makes three of us. That's 0 for 3.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's weird, right? Because I would, you know, my suspicion is that this would be one of the more, for a foreign film, right? And so that might probably puts it behind. But, you know, this is one that people still talk about a lot, right? Still absolutely love this particular film. And so it's really interesting that none of us have ever devoted enough time to it. So.
Yeah.
But we certainly didn't see it together because we didn't see it.
Right.
All right. So down to number 11. This is one of my favorite films of the year. I mean, I genuinely really love this movie. I watch it again with some regularity. It's Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, featuring force of nature, Terrence Stamp, and Peter Fonda, the late great Peter Fonda.
Yeah, tremendous. Probably my favorite. And I'm a really big Soderbergh guy, and I'm inclined to think this is my favorite. And I believe we did see I at least saw it with you, Rob.
We saw it together, definitely.
Yeah. And one striking thing is that I had sort of assumed that its reputation was really high, but, you know, I do like to keep a Blu-ray collection for the obvious reason that I don't want to pay for 50 streaming services and, movies go out all the time. Mm-hmm. It's actually not available in a Blu-ray edition, which is just shocking to me. Yeah.
Oh, that's really surprising.
It's just because I just sort of assume that it was as well known just how, it's just a beautifully made film, just really compelling, just so many amazing shots. And Stamp, who was always, one of the definite reasons to keep going back to Wall Street is that Stamp is just tremendous. I can dump the stock just to burn your arse. He's amazing. And like Fonda, who also like has barely more than a cameo, but is just like so perfectly cast.
He's so slimy. What's the phrase he says? The 60s were more of a feeling than a time. It wasn't even all the 60s. It was just 66 and part of 67. But when you were there, you knew what you were doing. You knew where you were. You knew your way around. And he's like the whole movie, like his new girlfriend is like he helped name her when she was a baby. It's so sleazy and so Hollywood. It was fantastic. I mean, just in conception.
Yeah.
You forget because the plot is really kind of, I mean, it's straightforward and interesting and fun. But I mean, it's shot in a really interesting way, too.
Right. And uses like, you know, time differences as interestingly as Pulp Fiction does. Just amazingly, just like so really well. And that's a movie that rewards a lot of rewatching, but you never get the sense that it's pretentious either. Like it's just all of the effects are necessary for the story, which is, I think, really one of the things, you know, Soderbergh is very good at, you know, he gives the level of direction, the story, you know, like he adds exactly the glitz and pace to the Ocean's movies, like your like solid middle brow epic, like Traffic is shot in a very straightforward, you know, and then The Limey is just like, it's arty without being pretentious, which can be so hard to pull off. And it's just, it does it just beautifully.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there are two other performances that are great in this movie. Luis Guzman is just absolutely fantastic. And really short cameo by Bill Duke as a DEA officer, which is so good. You know, the money. We look for the money. Go with God, right? I mean, that's the phrase that I take away from this. There's only one thing that I did not understand. Every motherfucking word you just said. Right? I mean, that's a classic. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've used that. I've used that in class before, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think Luis. The first time I saw Luis Guzman is on Law and Order when I think he was the guy who like burned down a social club in the Bronx and killed like 200 people. But of this era, he ends up being like a really crucial. Like, you know, he's a major part of the Paul Thomas Anderson movies. You know, of course, he's in Traffic as well. You know, he's just a really wonderful character actor. And often when like really good movies from this era comes up, you know, he's playing a prominent role in them. So I'm glad you remember that because he's terrific in this too.
Right. Yeah. And I won't give it away right now, but a few movies down the list here, we have another actor who made his debut in Law and Order, who plays a prominent role in one of the films we're going to talk about in a second. So number 10 is Topsy Turvy, which I have never seen.
Nor have I.
And my story is a colleague of mine, as I was mentioning to, you know, colleague, like, and it's, and I think David, at least, I think all three of us had a discussion, like, I really like Mike Lee. You know, this movie was really well regarded. And I really have no hostility towards Gilbert and Sullivan, but I just have no interest. And I actually had a colleague lend me her DVD, and I've still just never bothered because for just whatever reason, I just have no interest in sitting through like a 2.5-hour movie about Gilbert and Sullivan. But I don't even know why, but just for some reason, it just has never. And I guess I have shared company here, but for whatever reason, I've never seen it.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I think I have a similar kind of aversion. And I think, you know, through my adulthood, I've slowly come to learn that my aversion for musicals is really more of an aversion for Andrew Lloyd Webber. But I think Gilbert and Sullivan still kind of get caught up in that a little bit. I'm sure they're fine. I'm sure this movie is very good. Mike Lee is great. But it's getting down to it. Seems like a chore. I don't know.
Although, unfortunately, Aaron Sorkin has made me more skeptical of Gilbert and Sullivan again. So that's. have you guys seen that the cold open episode of Studio 60?
Oh, no. Good Lord. Yes.
It's no. Just like, no, I have not.
Yeah, it's worth looking at this. So the first two episodes are all about how, like, SNL's gone stale and Judd Hirsch gives, like, the network speech that Jeff Daniels would give again. And so there's literally two episodes building up to, like, this will be the brilliant thing that just not only sets new standards in American comedy, but transforms American culture. It's literally two episodes leading up to this. And what it all is leading up to is literally a Gilbert and Sullivan parody. Like, it's a song about the show sent to the tune of the Major General song. That's it. That's
the joke.
And it's somehow even worse than that sounds. just those awkwardly timed, just so bad. And what's amazing with that, and what people have forgotten, like, I think the newsroom was treated pretty skeptically at the beginning. Studio 60 got rave reviews. Like, the consensus of American critics were like, the American public is too dumb to understand this brilliant show. And looking, it's just amazing. That people, like, I understand, like, I'm not a West Wing person, but I can understand, even though it, of course, single-handedly defines American liberalism along with Harry Potter. But, like, I can understand its appeal, whereas Studio 60 is just, the whole thing is just nuts. It's like a story about how SNL is central to American, and also this idea that, like, the top priority of evangelicals were, like, stopping mildly dirty skits on, like, late-night TV shows. Like, it's 1995. Right. Yeah. Everything about it is surreal.
It was all better done with a little show called 30 Rock. Yes. And I would also add, right, when we're talking about Gilbert and Sullivan, right, that this is also, you know, is one of the all-time classic Simpsons episodes, right?
Yes.
With the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons with Sideshow Bob, Kelsey Grammer. So, okay, so coming down, and I would regard this as a problem film. And now, Scott, I think just you and I saw this together. Number nine, and it's a film which really hasn't gone anywhere. The Blair Witch Project. I mean, how do we even sort of think about this movie 20 years later?
Yeah, and I've never gone back to it, but I just sort of assume that it's, you know, it's one of those movies that it's. You know, it's the same with it. Like, I've never, like, been blown away by watching Bonnie and Clyde, but it's sort of like watching it 30 years after the fact is just, like, its innovations have been so subsumed into American movies that you forget what it must have been like to watch it for the first time. And I would guess that The Blair Witch Project would be like this. But I thought it was good. as being somebody who's not a big horror fan, I thought it was legitimately well done and scary. And I don't really have any reason to think that it wouldn't hold up in that sense. But it really is like, it's not super widely discussed today for being as massively influential as it was. But I think that often happens, that it's almost like that some movies are so influential, they just get taken for granted really quickly. And I think there was a really bad sequel too, right?
I think there might've been a couple of really bad sequels. I honestly don't know.
Right. I mean, which is sort of a horror film tradition, right?
Right.
Have a successful villain, it has to have some bad sequels.
So go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, no, it's one of those movies, like I didn't see it with you guys because I remember seeing it with some other people, and I have a very hard time kind of figuring out why it is that occasionally some horror movies actually do kind of work on me, kind of frighten me, scare me, and most don't. Yeah, this one really didn't. Just sort of I watched it, and I could sort of evaluate it as a success on its own terms. But it left me. It didn't do much for me. But that's more about me than the film. And it's
quite. I mean, even bad horror movies tend to scare the bejeebus out of me in ways that I find really unpleasant. So I don't watch actually a lot of horror films. I mean, so for example, when Wes Craven passed away a couple of years ago, it occurred to me that I really thought that the original Nightmare on Elm Street was just a fine piece of work, and I have never been able to watch it again. Right, and that is sort of just how I interact with horror films. But my reaction to Blair Witch was actually very similar to yours, Dave. Right, I could see it working as sort of a project without really being terrified by it. And I guess when we talk about how innovative it is, like, how are we isolating its innovation? Because, I mean, there's lots of shaky cam and so forth and found footage, and I guess that's influential. But, it seems like almost the viral marketing campaign before you had viral marketing campaigns innovative about this film.
Yeah, and I think, viral in ways that were less... there were some major studio campaigns like Miramax really used the twist in The Crying Game as well. But that was still done in sort of traditional newspaper ads. And then they tried it again with another movie called The Advocate, which didn't work. But this was just kind of a different thing. But it was. And it is true that it's very hard to sort of – I would be interested to know like what a young person today would think of this, having seen the movies that came in its wake and sort of well past the hype. I don't really know what it would look like with fresh eyes today. And I've never had the slightest interest in going back and rewatching it, which may say something. But having said that, I think it was like fairly well done for what it was.
All right, so propelling forward here slightly to Toy Story 2. In my brain, I actually struggle a bit to delineate where all of the Toy Stories begin and end. Like, I remember the first film very well. I remember the second film much less well. I mean, have both of you guys seen this? I know we didn't see it together.
Not. Oh, really? I have not seen any of the Toy Story movies. With no pride haven't for whatever
reason. Yeah, me neither. I think I looked it up earlier, and I was kind of surprised to remember that I had never seen it, because it seems like a movie I would have seen. The only Pixar films I've seen is there's like a 5-film run of The Incredibles, Cars, Ratatouille, WALL-E, and Up. Uh-huh. I never saw anything before or after that 5-film run.
Right.
So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sort of having seen this and, I've watched it with my daughters and, it does not stand out in the same way, in a way that I would have expected it to be on this list. So the first one does, and the third one certainly does to an extent. The fourth one I just didn't like. The second one does not stand out in a way that made it really, really memorable to me.
That's interesting. Maybe its critical reputation is higher than the other two, isn't it?
No, it really is. It's extremely high, right? And perhaps I just have to revisit. Or perhaps people were just very happy that a sequel was nearly as good as the original. But, I might have to go back and revisit it at some point.
Yeah, I'm reminded that our blog has multiple people, I believe, who believe that The Godfather is considerably better than The Godfather Part 2. Or is that just Loomis? Do either one of you think that? No, I know, Dave, you think Godfather 2 is better, right?
Oh, yeah, it's much better. Yeah, I mean, look, nothing against the first movie. It's good, but it's, yeah, it's not in the same league.
I don't understand that. And it's particularly weird because that it doesn't seem at all consistent with, like, Eric's taste in movies. That's what it's like.
Right.
There are many people who I can imagine, like, believing that, but it's just it's very difficult given what I know about. Like, and he particularly likes to mock the gold phone scene, which is an awesome fucking scene. That is a great scene.
It's a terrific scene. It's a terrific scene.
Yeah, the whole point is to, like, you have these executives who like the trappings, and Michael and you know, they don't care. You know, right. That's a really, really important point. That's really, like, but the whole Cuba sequence is just tremendous. But anyway,
Look, it would not be an LGM. I mean, the commenters have to have a something to grapple onto for why Loomis is wrong, right? I mean, they have to have a hook, and I think we've just provided it for him here.
So, Rob, would you say would you agree with the assessment that this is sort of the Toy Story series is one of the things that's one of the very few things in the world that justifies the existence of Tim Allen?
First the answer is yes. I would say the other thing that justifies the existence of Tim Allen is, of course, Galaxy Quest, right?
Which is another 1999 movie, by the way.
Is it?
Really?
Is it really?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my goodness! I mean, yeah, he does Shatner so perfectly, and Alan Rickman does such a perfect play on Nimoy. I mean, it's fantastic. We don't really have time to talk about it, but wow! I know I did not realize that 1999 was actually the year of Tim Allen.
Yes, in that
sense.
Every year is the year of Alan Rickman as long as he was alive.
That's right.
Yes, exactly.
That is really a tragic early loss. Like, that is really right. One of the great character actors ever.
Right. Right. All right, so number 7, and this one I am pretty sure that we all saw together, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong.
100%.
It's actually a film that I haven't thought about a lot lately until it was brought up. I want to say by Amber Lee Frost, accusing her political opponents of being the Tracy Flick character. I think she was accusing Elizabeth Warren of being the Tracy Flick character from this movie. But I mean, it's a terrific movie. It's really outstanding.
Oh, early Payne, like Payne's first movies are all just fantastic. Like Election and Sideways in particular, but really, up until The Descendants, I really like. I guess I didn't see his last one, which just seemed like a failure. But Rums, right? I didn't revisit it when I was like, I used it as my stand-in for all my James Comey posts. You know, I thought that would be good. Yeah. But it's a movie I've always gone back to. And actually there was a lot of interesting stuff written in that, in a sense, like, Hillary Clinton was Tracy Flick, but in ways that, like, a lot of people seem to, and there are people in our comments who, like, seem not to understand that, like, Broderick is, like, the bad guy in the movie.
Great.
As nothing they do is admirable. Like there was even a couple of people, trying to portray, like, yeah, but didn't she, like, get somebody fired? Like, he slept with his student. Like, she was not the bad actor in that scenario.
I believe statutory rape is the word, is the term that we would use to describe that relationship, too, right? So,
yeah,
but I do think it's one of the, it does what a number of Payne films have done. Which it does kind of trick you in, I felt like on the first viewing, it wasn't like I wasn't sympathizing with Matthew Broderick exactly, but I was kind of seeing things through his eyes. And I think I was sympathizing with him more than I realized I was doing. And rewatching it really kind of drives home the point of how Payne kind of gets you there, right? He sort of tricks you into sympathizing with the wrong person, even when you don't think you're doing it.
Well, and look, as teachers, I think we've all felt a certain annoyance at a certain kind of, apple polisher who's, like, trying to get her grades in a row. Like, I think that we all feel that. And I think that's part of it, is I think we can all understand that on some lower level. It's just that most of us can understand that. Well, that doesn't mean we should be sabotaging her. There's a mild annoyance, and then sort of going beyond that because you're, like, a really immoral person. But the movie wouldn't work if you didn't understand why people find her annoying.
That's right. And it took me until the end of the second time I watched it to really kind of have the revelation of there's nothing wrong with Tracy Flick, right? Yeah. Nothing serious wrong with Tracy Flick. Her flaws are perfectly ordinary teenage flaws. She's, but yeah.
Well, and you know, we do. They do dig in with his with what he expects his likely audience to be. That we find, you know, that, that she's with a Republican congresswoman at the end, and that that sort of thing, right? So he doesn't even let us off the hook, right?
That's right. That's right.
You know, and that's the epilogue, and but we're albeit the epilogue is also Matthew Broderick resisting in just the most pathetic possible way, right? So.
Right.
Another thing is that this movie also had like some really great performances by some like teen actors, most of whom are never really seen again. So, and even Chris Klein like hasn't been seen, who's very good. But I'm particularly thinking of like his sister,
right.
And then, you know, just some really, really great performances. But I don't think she was ever really seen again. But she's just terrific. Like, is really sort of the soul of the movie in a lot of ways. So that was really got. And that's one thing. Like, Payne is just incredibly good with actors. You know, and I think that that's something that really just like every role in this movie is just perfectly cast. Just really, really well done.
Right. Number six, I have not seen. It is Kiarostami's A Moment of Innocence. Have you guys seen this?
Yeah, Dave, you're the Kiarostami expert, so...
I have, and I struggled to sort of bring up... I was thinking about this. I thought I was thinking about this movie, and wait, this isn't Kiarostami, is it? This is Mandelbaum, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm really bad.
I haven't seen either of them, but I said Kiarostami because he's the first one here. It lists him first in the in the little write-up. So, never mind. My bad, peeps.
I was thinking, I looked through the list before we did our first one, and I was trying to, like, remember things, to have things to say about things that I'd forgotten. And it took me, like, I was thinking about what I thought was this film, and then I realized I was thinking about Close Up, which is a Kiarostami film that's also about Mahmoud. It's about someone who was impersonating Mahmoud to try and... But this film is fascinating, and I kind of... part of the story, and one of the reasons I'm hesitant to say anything too definitive is that I honestly don't remember. You know, both him and Kiarostami are kind of known for this sort of blending documentary and fiction in sneaky ways that you don't fully understand. And this movie absolutely is very good at that. So one of the conceits of the movie, and I forget how much of this is actually what happened and how much of this is straightforwardly fictional, is that he was a true thing is that Mahmoud did stab a police officer in the 70s during a protest and did spend time in prison for it and was released in 1979 as a political prisoner. And then he wanted to make a movie about that. And the police officer that he stabbed shows up and wants to play the part, and he's become an actor. And then it becomes this sort of mediation on memory and the event and what really happened when he was stabbed, and there was the girl, and maybe they were flirting. But, you know, and what I remember most about this movie is, like, particular scenes where people are arguing about memory that are just really kind of delightful. My memory is that this movie is more a sort of collection of interesting scenes than a successful overall movie. But the scenes themselves are really quite remarkable. It's definitely worth your time. It's something I really do need to revisit.
And interesting, I think that's also in many ways a description of the next movie.
Right. So, the next film is one where sort of I obliquely referenced before, and he doesn't actually have one of the starring roles in it, but this is one of the films. I don't know if he was in any other. I can't remember other films that he was in, but of course Philip Seymour Hoffman was in Magnolia, and he was the nurse to Jason Robards, and he also made his debut in Law and Order a very, very long time ago. Wow. But I don't remember if we watched this one together, but my goodness, is this a terrific movie with the Amy Mann soundtrack. I mean, it's really just absolutely fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love Anderson, and I love this. Mm-hmm. I would say that of his, you know, like sort of great, slightly uneven epics, I do like Boogie Nights a little more. Mm-hmm. Just because, and probably just because, like, the very best scenes, but, like, there's nothing in Magnolia that I think is quite as great as, like, the Alfred Molina mixtape sequence or the, you know. But you know, even though like Magnolia seems like it should be even better on paper, like I just feel like there are parts where it drags a little more. It's not quite, but it's still. I mean, these are minor quibbles. Like you know, like Boogie Nights is one of my favorite movies of the '90s, and like Magnolia is almost good. Hard Eight is also actually really good too, although very different. But it is, yeah. And actually, it's been a couple years now since I've watched it. But yeah, no, it's really, yeah, it's. Like there's just so many compelling performances, as you say, the sound, and not only Amy Mann, but actually finds a use for Supertramp, which is kind of like, amazing. And that's one thing. Anderson is up there with Scorsese in terms of like the use of music in Boogie Nights is just phenomenal. And especially with like period pieces, it's really easy for soundtracks to just be lazy and just kind of like run through greatest hits that are just sort of, you know, whereas like in these movies, just sort of the music is just perfectly fit to what's going on. You know, it's often not really obvious choices. You know, so he really and this hasn't always been true necessarily in his later work. You know, but I really think in these movies that just, you know, he's really, you know, that adds like a really major component, to what he's doing. So this is, you know, sort of this is the sort of the best film Robert Altman never made.
the Tom Cruise as the incel whisperer, grifter and motivational speaker is just.
Yeah, and
it's what Tom Cruise is for. I mean,
I don't want to steal your thunder here, Dave, but I would actually disagree with Scott. I think that sort of the best scenes with Cruise, which include, you know, sort of not only describing what he actually does with the incels, but also the interview where they are, you know, the interviewer challenges him. I like that as much as I liked anything in Boogie Nights, right? I mean, it's just Cruise doing exactly what he's good at.
Yeah, I could see, you know, and honestly, like if I were to watch, you know, I don't know that I've watched it since Trump won. You know, so there's very much like I would suspect I might now agree with you. Like, actually, now that I know, yeah, that's a, like that really is a remarkably prescient, you know, as we discussed with Fight Club, you know, that was something that, you know, like, again, I'm once again in the position of like the blank Black Klansman. And he was like, well, nobody like that could ever be elected in this country. So I think it is. But anyway, these are just two, I don't want to get sidetracked too much, but how do people, like, I still have not, unfortunately have not seen, and now I'm even blanking on the title, the Daniel Day-Lewis one.
The Daniel Day-Lewis
one. Paul Thomas Anderson with Daniel Day-Lewis playing like the severe, like dressmaker.
The severe dressmaker.
Oh, oh yeah. What was that?
Let us Google.
It was like 2 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like the idea that I would ever miss anything that was like Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis just seems nuts to me, but. I missed it in a tight window in the theater. Phantom Thread.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I didn't see it either.
Yeah, because look, I actually really liked Inherent Vice, and it's, you know, it's definitely not, you know, it will remind you a lot of Magnolia and Boogie Nights, and it's clearly not as good as those. But like, you know, it's sort of I actually found it was pretty entertaining in its own way, which is harder because, and The Master, I'm much more torn about. There Will Be Blood is outstanding. Like, I think
I have not seen The Master. I really want to see it. I mean, it's shocking that I haven't. But
yeah, it's not. It's what I would say is that it's so disappointing because, like, a movie like with Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman, essentially about Scientology, directed by Anderson, sounds like it's going to be one of the 10 greatest movies ever made. And also, and one thing is that it wasn't like it doesn't seem like Scientology just seems like a really fascinating subject. And Anderson wants to tell a story about male friendship, which I think is also very interesting, but has sort of been told many more times before. But I think that watching it again without the sort of incredibly high expectations I had going in, I actually think it's very good. I don't think it's as good as. His great late '90s work, but you know, it's still awfully good. And I also There Will Be Blood is better too. But
right. So there, it's worth noting here that, and we're not going to be able to get to this one, right? But there is another movie about Scientology from 1999, which is Bowfinger, which I know that I think Dave and I watched together, and I think both really enjoyed.
I think all three of us watched it together, and I liked it, but I liked it a little less than the two of you, I think. I may have seen it with somebody else. I know I definitely saw it in the theaters, and I don't know if I saw it with you or saw it with somebody else after your recommendation. Yeah, it's a pleasant movie. It was just, it was very enjoyable, but I felt it was, and I guess, you know, I mean, maybe it's not a criticism to say it was toothless. Like, it's obviously not really trying to be. But yeah, it wasn't, I was maybe a touch disappointed, but to say that could have been about my expectations again, rather than
what was it? Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise didn't know he was in that vampire movie until years later. All right, so getting a little back on track now. Number four, and this is a movie that honestly I hadn't thought about a lot, but you know, it's another movie that has Philip Seymour Hoffman in it. Now that it hadn't even occurred to me, but he plays really an asshole in this movie. The Talented Mr. Ripley at number four, which is, you know, I struggle to sort of assign this film to high cinema, but goodness gracious, it's enjoyable, isn't it? I like watching it.
Right.
Yeah, really just, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, like, Patricia Highsmith has been the source of a lot of great, like, Strangers on a Train is one of my favorite Hitchcocks. You know, and if anything, like, she, and also, I'm having trouble with my names today. But what was the adaptation of A Price of Salt with Rooney Mara and Carol? It's also really, really good, based on a Highsmith book. And this is one of the best, just really well. And I actually like the, you know, I think, and I believe Anthony Minghella died recently, right? And he like him in that. You know, and I think the introduction on the AV Club is good. He wasn't a fashionable director, but I think he shows, like, there's something to be said for somebody who makes, like, good, solid, middlebrow entertainments. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something. And clearly The Talented Mr. Ripley is his best movie. And I actually think, like, The English Patient, which is now sort of a punchline, is really actually not that bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
– I agree, yeah.
It was fun. Like, if you just, like, you know, if you accept that the source material is a little pretentious and it's a little bit, you know, and, like – you know, but this idea that it's, like, somehow unusual, like, you know, for, like, you know, love to put above, you know, it was fun. It was, like, it was not a great, it was, like, overpraised, but it was really right. Not bad.
Have you seen that English Patient movie?
And it's a great episode, don't get me wrong, but it ended up being a little unfair to the movie.
And Gwyneth is in this, and she's not bad, right? And, you know, Cate Blanchett is in it, and she's quite good. And of course, Hoffman is just really the asshole. So,
well, it really is one of Damon's best performances.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, he's fantastic.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. Although fantastic. I actually like, you know, I mean, like, Damon is, like, really crucial in the Ocean's movies. Mm-hmm. And I love The Informant, speaking of Soderbergh, which is incredible. That is a one, and that is another one that doesn't seem to be really widely discussed. But that is just a tremendously good movie, as well as the best context for Scott Bakula's talents that we've ever seen.
Although Scott Bakula again, we will be discussing him again today. So, all right. So at number three, and this one, I mean, this one's going to be interesting because, you know, I do not think we saw this one together, Scott. In fact, I don't think you saw this until years later. You could correct me if I'm wrong about that.
I did not see.
I mean, you had to be sort of convinced to watch this. Is the now Wachowski sisters, Matrix, The Matrix, and I did see this in the theater, and I was impressed, right? I mean, this was sort of the Keanu Renaissance, right? I mean, people forget now that Keanu was a joke in the 1990s, right? He was the mildly more successful guy from the Bill and Ted movies. And now he sort of has achieved cultural icon status in a way that was not predictable from the vantage of 1999, I don't think.
No.
Yeah. You know, I think it's, you know, it's as we were mentioning earlier, it's a really well-done B movie, like really, really good. And I don't mean that as a backhanded compliment. Like, that's actually a lot harder to pull off than you'd think. And it's like, it's really, really good. You know, and again, I have no, you know, it's just sort of a little unfortunate that Wachowski's, I think, you know, it was just, you know, a million philosophy classes were then, you know, taught out of this. And unfortunately, I think the Wachowski sisters got a little high on their own supply. Although you never really know, right? Because we've talked about many directors here who sort of made two excellent movies and then tailed off. So that just sort of happened. So I don't really know if that was even the press clippings of The Matrix so much as that sometimes people only have two great movies in them. But, you know, I mean, if your legacy includes Bound and the first Matrix movie, pretty good. There's sure a lot of directors who never direct one movie that good. You know, you can't say that. Now, Rob, what do you think about I saw the second sequel, which I didn't really like, and I avoided the third. What were your thoughts about this?
You know, you, I would not say either of them are terrible. You know, and I would say that either that both of them are sort of are linear from what the the ideas that the first is developing, right? And in a lot of ways, those ideas are actually pretty interesting. I mean, you know, there are ways in which they actually get Foucault kind of right, and they get Marx kind of right. In a way, in sort of structural ways that you don't expect from this kind of movie. But a lot of it just doesn't... I mean, one difference is they rely much more on CGI than the first film. And they open up the universe in ways that they can't really sustain from... I mean, the first film is wonderful because of its claustrophobia. And they lose that in sort of opening up the world in the second and third movies. I mean, I don't think either of the second and third movies are disastrous. They're not nearly as good as the first movie, but I don't think they're disasters.
Yeah. And I would say I'm a little bit more sympathetic to, you know, that there are some pretensions with the Foucault and Marx, but, you know, having now seen like 4 years of people who consider themselves Marxists and think the lesson of Marxism is that the right benevolent daddy can immediately smash all institutional constraints to progressive change with the force of rhetoric, I'm like, you know, they're a lot closer than that.
Right, exactly.
You know, so that it's, you know, that you know, and I think that, you know, the Matrix is a good thing where, like, some pretensions can be fun sometimes, you know, like as with Oliver Stone when he's good. It's like there's a lot of great art is made by people whose reach slightly exceeds their grasp. And I would definitely put at least the first one in that category. And again, I didn't think the second was designed like it was just sort of. I wouldn't say it was fully necessary, but certainly it was not disastrous or anything like that, unlike certain movies we may be discussing later.
Okay. Dave, what are your political theory thoughts on this one?
I'm inclined to agree, right? Like it didn't get in over its head, which it easily could have, and which is, I think, the reason I've avoided the sequels is my fear that they would, right? That's why it actually works to teach a class around it, right? In many ways it's not a modest film, but in its ideas it keeps things, you know, fairly straightforward and
right,
and that helps.
Well, and attaches them to the personal experience of an everyman, and Keanu does that well. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne is also really outstanding in this movie, and Carrie Ann Moss. And what's his name? The guy you were just mentioning from The Sopranos as the bad guy.
Joey
Pants. Joey Pants. Yeah, Joey Pants. He was terrific.
Also great in Bound too. Yeah.
Sadly, this represented the end of what we could usefully accomplish on the second edition of this now three-part podcast. But please catch the next edition, the next episode, in which we will talk about the last two films from the AV Club's top of 1999 list, as well as five other movies that we believed merited some discussion and some inclusion in terms of what the best films of 1999 were. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.